You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After the publication in 2007 of his best-selling memoir, A Long Way Gone, which shone a spotlight on the plight of child soldiers in Sierra Leone's Civil War, Ismael Baya went on to serve as a UNICEF ambassador, an advocate for children affected by war, and a member of the Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Advisory Committee. Now he's written a novel called Radiance of Tomorrow about the aftermath of that devastating civil war in one small village as the survivors attempt to rebuild their lives. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ismael Baya to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for it.
Could you begin by briefly telling us about the events that led up to when you became a boy soldier in the Civil War in Sierra Leone?
Yes, the war started in my country in the early 90s, and I was a boy. I was 12 years old, and I heard of it, but, you know, I never seen such violence in my community. And eventually, the war came into my part of the country, and it affected me, and I started running from it and seeing the things that I'd heard of. And through that time, I lost my immediate family. So my mother, father, and two brothers were killed in the war. And then I was along with other young people running from the war who had similar things happen to them. We went to a military base where we were recruited with no choice, really, to participate in the war.
Did you grow up in the village you grew up in, Mogwemo?
Mogwemo, yes.
Is that similar to Imperi, the setting for this novel?
Well, Imperi talks about a particular area. Imperi is generally a chiefdom, so it could be any several villages in that area, really. So I just try to imagine a combination of things.
How did you end up in the United States?
Well, first I came to the U.S. to a conference in 96 at the United Nations to speak about what had happened in Sierra Leone, alongside other children from Colombia, Sri Lanka, other places. And it was there that I met one of the organizers, the chaperon, one of the facilitators of this event called Laura Sims, a professional storyteller who lives in New York. And we became friends. So I went back to Sierra Leone, and when the war reached the capital city, Freetown, she got me out of the country and eventually fought hard for me to come, and she adopted me as a son.
Isn't it shocking that there are these child soldiers all over the world?
Yes, it is quite shocking, and it's continued to be. I mean, it's a global issue. And one thing that some people don't know, two things actually, is that armies recruit children. It's not just rebel groups, and also girls.
So it's the governments as well.
Governments as well recruit children, and they do it quite a lot, and also they recruit girls as well in both rebel groups and government armies.
So you went to high school and college here, and now you live in New York City, don't you, at least part-time?
Yes, I do live in New York City when I'm in the United States. It's my home, yeah.
And how often do you return to Sierra Leone?
I go home to Sierra Leone as often as possible. In a given year, I'll go 2-3 times, depending on what my schedule and my obligations are.
Do you have any surviving family members there?
Yes, I do have, my grandmother and some extended family members like uncles, aunts, and things like that, yeah.
But you lost a lot of family members.
My immediate family, yes. I lost a lot of them, yeah, and friends as well.
Why did you decide to write a novel as your second book rather than another nonfiction account of what's been happening?
Well, first of all, I think that for me, writing a nonfiction, a memoir, two times in a row, it's not the most healthy thing, in my opinion. But also for me, the situations that I was writing about are situations that I spoke to people about, observed and things, and some I use a lot of my imagination. So I wanted to use the fictional form to capture some realities that I can play with language and all the rest of it, you know.
But when you returned to your home village, did you interview people in preparation for writing this book?
Well, not a formalized interview because, frankly, in any place where there's been war, people are exhausted with interviews because everybody comes and asks them questions.
Because everybody's writing a book.
Everybody wants to write about them. So what I do usually is through casual conversations, because I speak most of the languages, through casual conversations, people will say certain things to me that they will resonate with. Tap into some parts of my imagination, and I would just play with it.
Yeah. When the novel begins, survivors of the war begin trickling back to the abandoned and largely destroyed village to rebuild their homes. Was this something that many people did, return to the villages to try to find their family members that they had lost touch with?
Well, it's something that people generally return to, whether it was a town, a city, a neighborhood. People returned and tried to reconnect find a way to live in this place again and find family if they haven't been able to find them. And some was not successful, some were successful, and there were difficulties that come with that. Because when you return, you're coming either from whatever your side of the war was, in a place where other people had not necessarily been who you had been in the war, you know.
And that is a problem because, well, that's part of the story you tell. A former child soldier who victimized a family has to live side by side with them. But the first people to return are the elders, followed by families with children, and finally some young people who are clearly former child soldiers. And they're all wary of each other at first, and for good reason.
Yes, even, you know, when I think some things that people don't realize sometimes, after war, when you return to the place that you had lived before the war, there's a lot of hesitancy in the air itself. Even how you greet people becomes different because you don't want to ask them, how are you? How is your family? They may have lost their families, and so you would open that wound for them again. So there's this hesitation and this sort of care that you have of how you relate to each other. And also, and of course, coming from different sides of the war, some amputated and so on and so forth.
Were you looking at the process of how people begin to trust each other again after such a traumatic experience?
Yes, I was looking at how people do that in that culture, in that tradition, and the traditional methods they use to rekindle that broken friendship with the land and with themselves and with their traditions again. How do you do that?
And are they conscious of having to establish that trust?
Oh, yes. They are very. Everybody's conscious. All the characters are very conscious of having to do that, and they are taking several measures. Now, the measures that they are taking are very traditional, and also it's a culture that's not really built upon discussing and analyzing what had happened. So they sort of, you know, find other ways to discuss the problem.
We have kind of already talked about the father who returns with his children. They all have had their arms chopped off by machetes, and the boy who mutilated them follows them there. Why does he want to be in the same town as his victims? I would think that he'd want to go somewhere else where he wasn't known.
Well, in some cases, some people will go on where they weren't known, but in some cases, some people will try to return to try and ask for some sort of forgiveness and to find a way to let the other person know that what had happened to them, what they did to them, was not of their own volition. And so he has been hunted by this. And the only way he felt that he could find peace within himself is to try and confront his family. So it's not just to ask for forgiveness itself. It's also for his own sanity as well.
And that's why he does little favors for the family, often not letting them know, because it's important to him to know that he is trying to atone for what he did.
Exactly, but also because if they let him know, they may the favors that he do for them or the gifts that he gives them, they may not like them if they know, you know.
The elders take the lead in rebuilding the town. Do the former child soldiers still respect their authority?
Slowly you begin to see, because as you mentioned rightly, during the war the authority has changed. The young people who had taken up arms and become quite strong in the army had a rare sense of power. So when they return, slowly, through the storytelling, the gatherings, you begin to see that changing. But initially, they don't. And they still feel a kind of, you know, they've developed certain characteristics from the war that they can be useful. And some of them, they need to tame down a little bit, you know.
My guest is Ishmael Beah, B-E-A-H. His novel, his first novel, is Radiance of Tomorrow. It is follow-up to his best-selling memoir, A Long Way Gone. The novel centers on two teachers, Benjamin and Bokhari, I guess is how you pronounce it.
Yes.
They're eager to return to teaching but become disillusioned when they realize the school principal is stealing their salaries. Is this kind of blatant corruption common?
Yes, some of these things are common. I mean, all of the characters, what you see about them is the fact that they, you know, they are doing things that are not proper, but also in some instances they are doing other things that are quite great. For example, the principal who is stealing the money is also paying for certain people's school fees and buying uniforms. So I really wanted to paint a picture in the wake of a war when people return to a place, they're trying to live together and what sort of challenges they face.
Well, know? Things are going relatively well until a foreign mining company arrives to resume operations. What are they mining?
They are mining all sorts of things, but in this particular context, they are mining what is called rutile, which is a mineral that's used in a lot of different things. And they also have bauxite, they have ilmenite, and then they have diamonds, of course, and other things.
diamonds were a major problem in the Civil War because both sides were fighting for them.
Yes, the diamonds became a strong part of the war because they actually fueled the war. They made it continue on longer. A lot
the
of people
diamonds.
Saw it as an opportunity to extract it then for cheap, you know.
But why is the mining a disruptive influence? Doesn't it provide jobs and create prosperity for the village?
Well, in the narrative itself, you see the townspeople are split on whether to support the company or not. Nobody's against, in the narrative, nobody's against the company. What they are against is what the company is doing to them and what is how it's destroying the land and how it's not consulting them to do what it is doing to their land. And also they're not benefiting from it directly, you know.
Well, the mining operation pollutes the water supply, treats its local workers badly. When some of the workers are accidentally killed, they dispose of the bodies secretly and then deny that it ever happened. Are these based on real incidents that you've heard of?
These are somewhat based on real incidents, and there are other versions of these incidents. It's somewhere in local papers in the country and some incidents. So I took some of those incidents and tried to use my imagination to explain what the reaction could have been and things like that. But some of these incidents did occur. Not all of them, but some of them did occur.
Well, the foreign workers also rape some of the village women. Other women are forced into prostitution. Are the mining companies operating in Sierra Leone as unethical as what you depict in this novel?
I think a lot of them are actually even more so, because what they do is that when they arrive into a place, particularly after war, when the country is hungry for anybody to come and invest, oftentimes we attract the wrong people who come and invest. And anybody who comes, we think, okay, great, at least they're here, because everybody's afraid to go there. And so then when they come, they change the population of wherever they come, because they come with all these men who then come into the town and they start to misbehave. And the dynamics of the villages and towns will change because of that. So these are the things I'm highlighting.
And they treat their own workers, the ones that they bring with them, a lot better than they treat the local workers.
Yes. Not only that, sometimes the workers that they promote to be in charge of the local workers even become the rebels against their own people. They treat their own people in a very nasty way. So you see all of these things unfolding.
Now, you don't mention where this foreign mining company comes from. You just call it a foreign company. But is it odd for you to live in one of the countries responsible for this kind of exploitation and witness what's being done to your homeland?
Well, it's not just what I wanted to say is just to explain that there are several companies that could come, not just from the United States, but even from Canada, from the UK, from Germany, from everywhere else who may have this sort of profile. You know, so that's really what. But the part of the writing is to really expose the issue, you know, so people can understand it, you know.
Several of the characters eventually leave the village and go to Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, to try to make a living there. I'm assuming that's happening a lot. We see that in a lot of countries anyway. But is there enough room for them in Freetown? Are there enough jobs?
The idea is that it's not necessarily about enough jobs or rooms for people in Freetown. There isn't, actually, in the capital cities. But people do come there because they expect this would be the only place where opportunities may be. And in some cases, yes, they are right. But then there are so many people competing for those opportunities as well. So you find nowadays the population has shifted in a post-war country in Sierra Leone, because everybody comes to the capital city and the towns and villages are a little bit emptier than they used to be in the past.
The language in this novel is much more poetic than in your memoir. And you write in an author's note that you were trying to translate your native language of Mende into English. How do you go about doing that? Did you write it first in Mende, or think of it first in Mende and then write it in English?
I think of it first in Mende because for me as a writer, I think that language fits landscape. When you situate your characters in a certain landscape, they have to speak a certain way. And also my language is very figurative, Mende, particularly in a lot of languages in Sierra Leone. So I think of things in Mende and I try to find the English equivalent of what they could be.
Well, do the rhythms of the two languages work well together?
In some cases they do, in some cases they don't. And then that's when I have to find what could be equivalent, you know.
Is there a written literary tradition in Sierra Leone? Because I'm assuming that English was taught in a literary way when Sierra Leone was a British colony.
We have other languages. When I was in school, we are not taught in school. But nowadays, they are taught in school. People are learning how to read and write them. But during my time, there wasn't. It was considered vernacular. So English was the medium. But we come from a very oral culture, so where, you know, stories and everything is passed orally. So.
But the number of African writers and filmmakers once had the great honor to interview the Senegalese filmmaker and writer Ousmane Sembène, and it was important to him to start writing down the languages of his country and establish a literary tradition. Because originally he just was writing in French.
Yes, it is important to do that. But for now, for me, what I'm trying to do is trying to preserve the methods and the tradition through writing itself and keep it in that form for now. And back home, then try to create a way to keep those things intact. You know?
You've worked as a UNICEF ambassador and advocate for children affected by war and as a member of the Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Advisory Committee and for other organizations. Have you worked directly with other former child soldiers?
Yes. In the capacity as a UNICEF ambassador, I do two things. One of them is policy work, and the other one is actually to go on the ground alongside with UNICEF workers, go into the field and actually negotiate or witness that negotiation of the release of children who are carrying weapons. Of recent, I did a lot of that in Central African Republic, where it's now a big mess.
And what do you say to them?
Well, initially, first, we have to release them. And then when they're given to us, we're taking them in the car to drive them. They seem very uncomfortable and uncertain about where is their life going to go. And I know those feelings because I'd felt them before. So this is when I'll come in and say to them, I know how you're feeling right now, but you've actually made one of the greatest steps, which is the rest will be difficult, of course, but you've lived so far. So that in itself is a triumph.
You've also started your own foundation, the Ishmael Beya Foundation. What does it do?
What I do with the foundation is that it started during the first book. For me, one of the things that changed in my life, really, besides having a home, having a family, is the opportunities that were granted to me to be able to access education and discover my own mind and things I can do with myself. So the foundation is essentially built around that, to give opportunities to young people, whether through education, entrepreneurship, small businesses, whatever, so that they can do some things with themselves, so they don't choose violence as an option.
You're married, aren't you, expecting your first child?
Yes, I am.
Where do you want to raise your family, here or there? And do you think of yourself as, because you've lived here probably as long as you lived in Sierra Leone, do you think of yourself as an African, an African-American, an American?
No, I think of myself as a Sierra Leonean with some American tendencies. I do want to raise my child definitely in Sierra Leone because I want them to have access to the wisdom, the tradition, the beauty, the simplicity of the place that I grew up and the place that's actually stronger within me than any other place that I've been.
You have a degree in political science from Oberlin College, don't you?
Yes.
I've read somewhere that you have thought about going into politics in Sierra Leone. Are you still serious about that?
No, I've never explicitly mentioned that I want to go into politics. What I've said is that I'm interested in the development of my country and seeing it it prosper. And whatever capacity that I can do that, then I'll lend that service, definitely.
And you see this novel as part of that process?
Yes.
You think of it as a political novel?
No, I see my writing generally as part of the process of trying to speak about my country, trying to have people understand my culture, my tradition, and my people.
Well, the story you tell here is relatively sad. So where does the title Radiance of Tomorrow come from? Do you see this story as ultimately hopeful?
The story is hopeful. The point that I'm trying to make in the novel is this. I think often when people think about happiness, they think that it is the absence of any challenge. But what I'm trying to say is that you see people with the backdrop of all of these difficulties, they are still able to genuinely love each other, have tremendous fun with each other, and keep a family together and do all of these things. That is the hopeful quality of the novel. That's what I hope people will see in between the reading.
I'm assuming you're working on another book, fiction or nonfiction?
I'm working on both, and I would decide which one I publish first, probably the fiction first. Yeah.
Ishmael Beya's latest book is a novel called Radiance of Tomorrow. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Drew and the Sarah Crichton Books imprint, and it has been my great pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.